I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. The year is 2016, the album in Glendale, the artist Tim Heidecker, and my guest Nick Robes. Nick, thanks for being back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I enjoy this process every time.
I should have left it open. So I pulled up the In Glendale page on Wikipedia, and I need to just read to you the terrible, whatever fan wrote this, or person who thinks they understand comedy wrote this. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to shit on people, like, first thing, but
sure.
This doesn't give you an idea of what the record is. They wrote, In Glendale is the second solo album by American comedian Tim Heidecker, released on blah, 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 blah. The album is not a parody like his usual absurdist comedy and garnered some positive reviews. I'm sorry, parody and absurdist comedy are not the same thing.
Sure.
And a whole album is rarely a parody on its own. If you parody an entire album, I want to hear it, but that's not a thing. What I think they're trying to say is it's not a comedy album. However, it's a comedy album. There's plenty of comedy in it at the very least. At the very least, there's plenty in it.
Yeah, I was actually having this conversation the other day about Bo Burnham's new special, Inside, with somebody, and my thing with Bo Burnham for a long time has been that I find his irony to sometimes be very alienating because I think that comedy really needs a point of view to be able to come across and have like some sort of grounding, and sometimes I'm not sure if he's being ironic to a point where he believes it or he doesn't believe it. And so I was talking about this I used reference like the stand-up thing of like, I was walking down the street the other day. No, you weren't. That's a lie, but you need that to get to the joke,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah.
And so the person was like, well, I don't really think of it as a stand-up special. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? No, it is like, it is very obviously he's parodying stand-up, but it's very obviously in the dialogue of stand-up. There's a stool and there's a microphone. Uh-huh. There are songs, yes, but it's supposed to be understood within a context of stand-up. So, like, I think this is very similar where it's like, it's supposed to be understood in the context of a comedy album, but the thing that's interesting to me about it is that he's then plussing it. He's going somewhere else with it, which seems to be very, and now we're talking about In Glendale, it seems to be, like, very honest somehow to me.
Yeah, no, I think so too. It's one of those, it is a bridge to maybe some of the stuff that I haven't heard all of, but from what I understand, where he actually does sort of start to do serious records a little bit, or at least more so than this. So this feels like maybe a bridge from maybe the most upsetting levels of irony and distracting levels of pretending to not give a fuck about what you're doing. It's one of the reasons I was hesitant to ever interview Greg Turkington on the show, but I had to have him on to ask him about... you want to get somebody like that in the room because you can appreciate what they're doing, even if it's not your thing all the time. But you can also, if you over-examine things, feel really stupid if you feel like you don't get it. And then you have to sort of realize that maybe there's less to get and there's more to just enjoy and experience, which sort of became the reality of it. But you do want to shake somebody like that and say, what the fuck are you doing? Can you just make it easier for me to understand? And of course, an artist is not going to do that.
Yeah. Are you a Tim and Eric fan?
I'm not of the show. And I won't say I don't but it is not my thing. I didn't see enough of it because there was a point where like, okay, I feel like I get this. I'm good. I can't take it. It stresses me out to watch it was most of what it is. It was too stressful to watch, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I'm not gonna say that I think it's harmful in any way or that, you know, it's not intelligent or smart or has its own thing going on. But it's definitely not my bag.
Yeah,
like I'm not sitting down on a Saturday and being like, you know what I want to watch right now is Tim and Eric.
Yeah,
if it comes on or if somebody shows me something, 9 times out of 10, I'm like, that's super interesting. Is it laugh out loud funny? Close, maybe sometimes.
Right.
The Steve Brule thing's great, but like, yeah, it's not necessarily my bag.
Right.
I don't know why I bought this record.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But I'm super glad I did.
It is, it does, there was a point, so at the beginning, I'm like, okay, is there going to be any element of, like, Because this came out in 2016. So by this time, you know, anybody who listens to a podcast from outside of LA is used to hearing references to The Grove, etc. And I'm like, is there going to be a reference? He doesn't get there till the very final track where he references the promenade in Santa Monica, which is at least another Los Angeles outdoor shopping center. And I just feel like at some point one had to make it in because it's just, it's part of, this seems like a, this is about, it's about living in LA. It's about how absurd talking about living in LA is. It's about how absurd pretending that that could somehow ever be relatable, especially the deeper you get into it. And, but it's also at the same time, first of all, beautifully produced. It sounds so good.
Like musically, it is baller.
Yeah. It's, I mean, and it starts at that first one and they all kind of follow this, but it's kind of dad rocky, but in a very good way.
Sure.
His voice is like fine. It's not like the most beautiful rock voice of all time, but it is used in such a way where it's like, okay, we gave him the best, you know, he uses his own voice in the best way possible to sound as good as it possibly can.
Super authentic.
Yeah. There we go. Thank
there's
you.
No
that's the word.
There's mm-hmm. no ridiculous overproduction.
Right.
It's, and it comes across as like, you know, Warren Zevon or like, you know, some of these people who aren't necessarily like Andrea Bocelli, I guess. I don't know. What are we talking about? The peak of singing. Josh Groban?
I don't know. My next thought. Josh Groban, yep.
yeah, and it doesn't...
Cleaning up the dog shit. That's a human adult man who's roughly my age who I'm supposed to take seriously because he sings like that. Sorry. Sorry, Josh Groban. No shitting on you. You have a beautiful voice, but it's a weird voice.
One of my favorite stories I heard on a podcast, apparently he has the number 2 Christmas selling album, and he was at a cookie Christmas party, and he was totally cool with everybody just calling him number 2 all night.
All right, I'll take it. You know, that's he's got a good sense of humor. Josh Groban's an okay actor, too. I'll give him that. He's not a bad actor. He has a series on Netflix. Did you know that? Lasted a
no.
season. Do you know who plays his dad in this series?
John Lithgow.
Oh, that's a good guess. That's better casting than the actual answer, which is Tony Danza.
Oh.
It's a weird.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. it's a mystery show. Anyway, this is not the Josh Groban hour. We're talking about Tim Heidecker. We're talking about In Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
Did you listen to this all the way through the first time, and what were you thinking as you listened to it?
So I the show would suggest I bought it on vinyl. Once again, no idea why, but I did. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't listening to it yet. Like I didn't like get home, tear open the packaging, and throw it on the mm-hmm. turntable. But a buddy of mine came over. We were talking about this like weird project I had in my head. And we were sort of wrapping up and like having a beer. And then he was like, what is this? And like, I just had it leaning against something. He's like, Tim Heidecker album. He's like, I love Tim Heidecker. I was like, cool. I was like, should we listen to it? He was like, all right. So I put it on and it was honestly like, just, it clicked immediately. And we just listened to the whole thing together. And we were both laughing and having like a ball, just listening to this album together. It was a really beautiful moment. And then so having that experience, all of a sudden I was like, well, I got to listen to this thing a few times and, you know, throw it on Apple Music in the car and just listen to it a bunch since then. And, go through everything from just enjoying it to like over theorizing about it and analyzing it and then just being like, well, that was dumb. And then just going back to listening to it.
Yeah. It's the type of comedy that hums at a level that does make you want to over theorize and then makes you wonder, is that the joke? Did he want me to think too hard about it? And then I'm an overthinker about comedy myself, obviously. Why else would I do this show? But like, fuck's sake, man. Like, but I will say, having to burn through this because of my terrible timing, having to burn through this right before you and I started, basically, because I'm terrible and I have no timing whatsoever as a human. I was half like, okay, cool, I get the joke. And then half like super impressed, obviously, as to how well put together it is and just how it does weirdly, I won't say totally condenses the LA experience, especially when you consider that from his perspective, he's a murderer in one song and several other things.
I don't know why that's the thing that I do.
That's so fucked up. I love it. By the way, how can you listen to that and not be like, this is a comedy album? It's not even, you and I have discussed Randy Newman on here before. There's an argument to be made for either side with Randy Newman, I think. This is a step above satirical. It is not just a little bit of dry satire. He literally talks about murder. Now, so does Weird Al, but Weird Al through the rest of his stuff is, you know.
I would also put it like a little bit closer to like a Werewolves of London. Like, mm-hmm. is Werewolves of London supposed to be funny, or mm-hmm. you know, it's like, right. well, yes, but like in a comedy sense, or just like funny, ha ha, versus this cheese smells funny, funny. I don't know.
All right, right. It's an interesting comparison, Nick. This cheese smells funny. The song. Okay, so I mean, should we go track by track here, Nick? What should we do?
I'm fine going track by track because I think this album also builds very nicely.
Yeah. It does start out with the title track in Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's about living on a hill in Glendale.
He has one of the subtle moves that happens throughout the album.
Mm-hmm.
He figures out these like these classic rock lyric moves that in classic rock context, they never really stick out super yeah. much, but I've always found it funny. Like Huey Lewis does this all the time, where they just start listing things for no fucking reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, he just lists off states. He's like, Montana, Wyoming. And, like, it makes sense in the context of the song. But, like, it always cracks me up when classic rock artists do that. When they're yeah. just like, Detroit and another city and another city. And it's like, why are you just naming places? And so he does that. Yeah. And it's like, it's not an overt joke. He doesn't make it. He doesn't Family Guy it where it goes on too long.
Yeah.
But it's subtle.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it gets to the last chorus. And, like, it sounds like he's stoked to live in Glendale.
Live in Glendale.
Well, I'm living in Glendale.
Which, if anybody understands, there's no reason to be excited about living in Glendale. But you can be satisfied. I think that's the best you can be, is satisfied to live in Glendale. I think.
Part of this, like, this album situates itself in like so many different vectors that are like sort of intersecting of like classic rock and comedy and like all these contexts that like, sort of homage-y, but like also sort of moving it in its own direction. So like the idea of living in Glendale, actually most of these songs are about super amazingly banal, like quotidian bullshit. Mm. Like, I'm just living in this town, or the fucking good looking babies, we'll get there. But yeah. like, there's no magical realism. There's no like
right.
romanticizing really. Like it's very straightforward and very matter of fact about all of its subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, central air. It doesn't really go much beyond like, he's just talking about air conditioning. Right. And living in Glendale, like all these flyover states, like they're probably fine. He's not even saying like California's right. the shit and fuck these other places. He's like, they're probably fine, but this is where I live and that's what I'm happy about. It's so simple.
Yeah.
And if he said it straightforward, like without music, it would be like, okay, you like living in this place. But music somehow takes this like,
yeah,
this super banal idea and elevates it. And that's honestly what a lot of classic rock does.
Yeah.
Think of Little Pink Houses or Little Pink Boxes, right? No.
Little These Houses, yeah, you're right.
Little Pink Houses. Pink yeah. Houses by John Cougar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Little Pink Houses for you and me. Like, it's like, oh, okay, we both get a house? Cool.
Right. You know what? That's fair. It is fair. And it is also technically less of it's less ironic for him to do it, because I feel like Tim Heidecker, while he's a very well-off gentleman, will never be as rich as like a John Cougar Mellencamp. And I feel like the idea of somebody being a like a working comedian or a working actor doing a big album about how they're doing just fine is you know, the joke in and of itself. And also if you want to take it down to who he really is from what I can gather the few times he's ever been serious.
Absolutely.
Yes. I'm going to have to, that's all it's going to be. He does seem like a person who is, if not down to earth, endeavoring to be down to earth, except for when he's doing comedy. The rest of the time is he seems to be a very nice, normal human gentleman who, hates bad people and likes good people. And, he's, you know, he and I are very much on the same page. We just have different ways of expressing, our hate and love for things.
I will also say, he puts himself in the tradition of Randy Newman. Like, I think in the liner notes, he puts it, you know, Warren Zevon, Randy Newman, all those kinds of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't seem as mad as Randy Newman is about shit.
No.
Until he starts, you know, later albums, he's talking about Trump and shit like that. But, sure. Albums are kind of, joyful sort of looks at the human experience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And just like how much joy there is in dumb things.
Mm-hmm. The next one, so the next one is Cleaning Up the Dog Shit, which I mean,
great.
It does start out with the line, I got a baby now, don't ask how, it just happens after a while.
Yeah.
Which, again, the mundanity of just being a human being who can survive enough to live a life. It's, God. I don't
think
he.
And it keeps me feeding her, which keeps her alive.
God damn it. That's good. That's very good.
I don't think there's much beyond that. Like, you know, everybody who's had a kid has that moment where the kid's in the hospital for the first time and they like see their baby and they're like, you know, tearing up and they're like, this is the most beautiful moment of my life. And everybody around them is like, that's cool for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I give a shit about you as a human being, but like, I don't give a fuck about your kid. Like, aside from like a member of the human race, you know, like,
sure.
I'm not tearing up being like, this is the most beautiful thing. In fact, it looks like a weird alien shit bird, you know, it's purple and spotty. It's got goo on it. Like, fuck this thing. And that's kind of what he does.
Yeah.
He toes that line of like, there's nothing beyond it, just that this thing has to survive. But music elevates that to like, this is profound.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there, again, because you are, you have more musical references and knowledge than I do, is there anybody in, like, specifically that any of this feels more homage-y to than anybody else? I mean, I don't know. Do we hear a Bob Seger? Do we hear anything in particular? Whenever I think of that shit, I normally think of Bob Seger. Maybe it's because I'm living in Michigan now that I'm thinking about it.
I'm living in Michigan! Just at the sip. I love that. I love it when I can get just as somebody's taking a drink. Oh, yeah. Joke now. It's the horns or something, but I was getting a lot of like E Street Bandy kind of vibes. You know, sort of like a River era Bruce Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
And this one in like England and sort of the more like horn based stuff. That's kind of what I was getting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's harder for me to nail down.
Like Dylan-esque and
sure. Yeah. For me, it becomes harder to nail down because again, unless somebody's doing an obvious impression, I'm going to be lost. And he doesn't. Again, he's singing like Tim Heidecker. He's being as Tim Heidecker as he can throughout the whole thing.
Yeah,
which is why, by the way, what carries it for me is that apparent actual sincerity. I don't know how deep I need to get into examining whether it's sincere or not. It sounds sincere, mm-hmm. and it works, and it carried it enough where I was at no point was this cloying or annoying or I can't handle this or this is too much irony for me. It was like, no, this is good. This is keeping it going, and the music's beautiful. So,
I also if we attack it from like a humor standpoint, I think it always punches up. Like he's talking about all this like banal sort of, let's get hyperbolic, stupid daily things.
Mm-hmm.
But it never punches down to the stupidity or the banality of it. It's elevating these things.
Right.
And that's what the humor is there's profundity in these incredibly like small minute slices of life.
Yeah.
And that's that I think might add to that authenticity that I think we're both sort of vibing on.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. The next song is just entitled Work From Home.
Okay, so I was talking about those like vertices earlier of like intersection. Does this remind you very specifically of another song?
No, but that doesn't mean that it's not accurate. Tell me what you're examining.
I'm calling in sick today.
Oh my God, yeah, of course. Good call. I'm an idiot. Good call.
It's so funny to me because similarly, like, to like, he's wearing his influences on his sleeve through the other songs. This one to me feels like the most like overtly, this is a comedy song.
Mm-hmm. I'm pulling up the lyrics. I am not ignoring you. I am pulling up lyrics, by the way, because I realized I didn't pull them up.
Yeah, no worries. This feels to me most like a comedy, and this is the one that I think has a video, and that might have been the single and stuff.
Okay.
But it also kind of feels like, oh yeah, this has been tackled before in song form.
Right.
And once again, it's not derivative. It's it's not overly obvious in that it's having a conversation, but it feels part of a larger, you know, comedic dialogue, or like, you know, which I think is so fascinating about this album as a whole, is that it does feel like it's having a dialogue with all these different elements and authentically. So comedy, it very obviously is like treading territory that's been tread before, but in a unique way. And musically, it's living in this, you know, sort of dad rocky Warren Zevon, Randy Newman-y world. And
I had not. Well, now I'm going to have to re-listen to it just specifically now looking for that influence. But that's a very good point.
Weird Al. And I mean, he might not have even thought of the Weird Al song, but
sure,
there is a comparison to be drawn, which then puts this, you know, in a like a space, a three-dimensional space, reference-wise or culturally.
Yeah, that's fair. That's perfectly fair. Fuck this lack of lyrics.
Yeah,
sorry,
I believe
I'm trying to find
Wittgenstein would call that a family resemblance.
Wonderful. Again, Nick goes over my head and makes me look like a dick on my own show. That's
don't worry about it. Everybody pretty much, I'm sure, asserts that I'm the dick for pulling down that reference.
No, Nick. I have a smart audience. They'll who's fully willing to accept when I'm an idiot. That's okay. That's good.
That reference that all the kids love, 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein.
It's a good name. I know it from a Monty Python song. This is where my brain is.
Wittgenstein was a beery swine.
It was just a Schlossenschlegel. Less impressive that I can quote that song. Less impressive. Let's be honest. A white guy who can quote Monty Python? Wow. Please, let's give him the MacArthur Grant.
I mean, it's way better when you do it with James Urbaniak.
Sure. That was... God, that was an experience. That was an interesting experience.
I always found it funny that they pronounce it "I digger."
Yeah. I guess because they're being as Australian as possible.
Oh yeah.
I'm assuming.
Bruce.
I don't know. G'day, Bruce. I mean,
Bruce teaches logical positivism.
So fucking stupid. Ghost in My Bed, Nick. Oh, it's shorter than I. That's so good. It's a quick burn of a song. Some of these, by the way, are like less than 2 minutes.
This one I feel like is very Zevon-y. More like a Werewolves of London kind of vibe.
I mean, it is a quick comedy song about murder, and a ghost following him around that may or may not be. He's not sure if it's real or if it's in his head.
Right. But it's a funny idea that he's interfacing with himself in such a confused way, because he's murdered somebody, which is a very definitive act.
Sure.
Like, somehow he has cut off this person's head. Time consuming. Does not happen immediately, I'll tell you what. And I don't know that from personal experience, but, it's definitely a very purposeful thing. Buried head under the Hollywood sign. Once again, digging a hole. Not very quick. He's also questioning why he's doing it. He's like, why did I bury, you know, why? I just don't know. I gotta turn myself into the cops. Like, it's this like very bizarre sort of analytic, dry mm-hmm. version of being like, oh, I've committed this crime of passion. this is awkward. Check, please. You know, and it's also with that like super upbeat, like, you know, all of it together. It's just like, oh, great. And then it's in and out before you even really have time to digest it.
And I mean, I always enjoy when someone, again, shoehorns in a reference to make the song relevant to the whole album, quote unquote. So if it's if it is theoretically about life in L.A., he had to bury it under the Hollywood sign. Otherwise, it's not an L.A. song anymore.
You're right. Yeah.
It's like he has to the most L.A. thing possible.
Holly weird.
I love that you picked this after I've moved away from L.A. It is kind of perfect to listen to a record about the experience, quote unquote.
And a little bit of closure.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of closure. Thanks, Nick. Thank you so much.
A little bit of closure.
The boys in gray are at it again.
This goes out to Deborah in Los Angeles.
One more fucking dead dog dedication. God damn it.
Get Don on the phone.
Get Don on the phone. Son of a bitch.
So much fun.
Let's talk about Good Looking Babies, which I can't pull up the lyrics to, and I realize I didn't write any notes about, so walk me through it, Nick. This is the longest song in the whole record.
Super long, which is opposite of Ghost in My Bed, obviously. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is actually the sort of statement of the whole album. I feel like this is kind of where it really dives into like what it wants to say and really emphasizes that whole stupid bullshit thing and trying to elevate it, because there's no story, like there's no like arc for these people. Mm-hmm. They sort of end up almost basically where they started, aside from the narrator, which that is one of the greatest endings to a song of all time. Just like he's telling this super boring story and then he gets to the end and he's like, yeah, I'm sailing around the world. Wait, no! Why don't you tell that story?
So good.
You know, whatever. I, you know, fought the pygmies off of the coast of Zanzibar. But these two people, you know.
That's good. I love it.
Everything is hinted at. Mm-hmm. Or everything that they do is never, like, super extreme. Like, he's flirting with other girls. He never actually, like, cheats on her, really. She has this, like, you know, lesbian experience that's, like, it's not super graphic, like her and the other girl kiss. Okay. Their relationship is like, it never, like, they never fight. Mm-hmm. Really? It's always like, oh, well, they're doing fine. It just sublimates, like, oh, there's some problems. Like, but, like, you know, they're not calling each other whores or something. Like, it never goes anywhere. Yeah. And the song does that musically, too, because it just keeps kind of. Just repeated figures, sort of laconic, until it gets to the chorus. Looking babies all around. Even that, it's just like, not like they're gorgeous. Even them, they're like, you know, they're fine looking people. Good looking all around, you know. She might have weird feet or something, I don't know. So it like really pushes that. The other thing that I think is so interesting about this approach, and to me it feels very experimental, because one of my pet peeves in pop song writing especially is using emotional situations that have like built emotional baggage as like a crutch. So, like, you talk about, like, you know, a dead relative or, you know, something like that, and it never adds to the emotional complexity of the subject matter. It just uses that as a preconceived emotional nugget that people are going to talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, basically just, like, somebody with an acoustic guitar being like, racism is bad, and it's like, well, yeah, man, whatever. Sure, but you know, sure. Then you go to like somebody like Run the Jewels or something, and they're talking about racism in a way that's unique, and it doesn't fall on that emotional crutch, they have something to say about it. Tim Heidecker's lyrics on this album never really explore any of these things. It just kind of lays them bare.
Yeah.
Like a super naked, just kind of straightforward situation. It doesn't dive into it. It doesn't crack it open. It doesn't unpack it. It just kind of leaves it for the music to kind of elevate it to a point where you have to then crack it open. And I love that subtlety. I love that relationship to pop music, you know, like a John Cougar Mellencamp or like a, you know, a Bob Seger, you know, turn the page sort of kind of element. Also, I would put kind of George Thorogood a little bit into this one.
Okay.
Because George Thorogood has those like long rambling fucking stories that just go on while a beat happens.
Yeah. Okay. You
know, Bartender says, look, come down here. So I come down there. It's like, we got there. Okay. Is this still going on? It's been 10 minutes, dude. But this one, he really just like, he just lays out this narrative kind of, and lets it happen. And you're just kind of like, oh, wow. It just, and then it like constantly goes for a rhyme and then he just doesn't rhyme. You know, he just constantly like said, like is trying to cram too many words into a thing. Like he just does it. And it's all these moves we've heard before, but people were doing it because they, you know, that's how they wrote songs. And he somehow seems self-conscious of it. And it's really, it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm trying to fucking talk here, dude.
So on a level, that Wikipedia person's entirely wrong, because I mean, what you were describing is a very subtle, very deep, very knowledgeable parody. It is parody. It is style parody. It is conceptually parody. It is just not, it's not Weird Al, and obviously I would never shit on Weird Al. I like Weird Al's version of it, but this is
different.
Complex. It's complex.
Yeah. Because it
hides as a different type of comedy, though. If what you're saying is true, and I believe it to be true, and I find your analysis more adept than mine, then yeah, if something is hiding as a different type of comedy and yet is another kind entirely, that's I don't even know what we call that. I don't know what you would call that, but I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can still call it parody, but it's just, it's not, you have to kind of take the word at face value instead of putting with it, you know, associations of parody. You know, it's not Lonely Island, you know, obviously.
Sure. Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be. It's not trying to be. And I'm not saying that one's better than the other. They just exist. The world of parody might be more manifold than we, you know, have sometimes thought of it.
Yeah, I agree. Brilliant. All right, let's end the episode there. That's the smartest thing that's going to get said today. Not true. You'll probably say something else smart. I'll give you. Okay, the next one is now the shortest song on the record, which is When the Cash Runs Out.
Which is where he's like, he seems to be interfacing the most with Tim Heidecker, right?
Uh-huh.
Because this seems to be where he's like, he's living in Glendale, you know, or even, you know, I'm assuming he had a kid by the time he wrote, you know, Cleaning Up the Dog Shit.
Sure.
But this seems to be the most obvious one where, like, you could paint this onto Tim Heidecker, the person.
Okay, yeah.
And Tim Heidecker, the character, and the you know, person, the Venn diagram is turning into a circle.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
But it also just, I love that fear. I think it's super relatable. Like,
yeah.
Even if you're not, you know, a Hollywood person or talking specifically about acting or writing or something like that. Like, I don't know. Any freelancer feels this all the time.
Absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
It is
the cash runs out. I have to get a goddamn job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's one of those things where, because if you hear somebody who you know is well off express that fear, you're always like, is this legitimate? Is this real? Do you really, Andy Kaufman, did you really need to work at a restaurant for the first 3 years of Taxi or whatever? Because it feels like a bit. Everything, right. You know, and I mean, that is the challenge of Andy Kaufman, as we all know. What was a bit? What wasn't? Was he living a bit? Was he not? And so I'm always suspicious, and I think at the same time, this probably, as you say, it airs on the legitimate. It feels like it's legitimate, and at the same time, I always question it, which I think is he probably understands that people.
Yeah, and you probably also should, because this is also the most vulgar song on the album, right?
Yeah,
I don't think he drops an F-bomb in any other song.
Right. Yeah.
So I mean, the fact that it is that like aggressive and vulgar compared to everything else adds to the you know, the idea of it, you know. Mm-hmm. Like goddamn, so, you know, what is it? Hold on, let me look it up really quick. Like a fucking when the cash runs out.
Why couldn't I find the lyrics? You're gonna find them quicker than I can. But to be fair, I'm doing it in the middle of
Apple Music. Just has it right in the app. See. It's the best.
That would have been smart for me to look at the lyrics part, I guess. I'm a genius.
Oh yeah. When the cash runs out, I'll be just like you. The 9 to 5 and the fucking commute. When the cash runs out,
mm-hmm.
You know, it also like it's him and it's the listener. He's like mm-hmm. putting us together in the same space now, but in this world that's like aggressive.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, and it's the only time that he's really commenting with an mm-hmm. attitude on about anything. Because even when he kills somebody, he's confused. Yeah. But like he's not like, you know, there's a I'm going to hell. It's not
right.
Wow, I really fucked up and mm-hmm. I'm regretful. It's I should probably turn myself into a ghost. And now I'm in hell. You know, mm-hmm. this is the first time where he's like the fucking commute and you know, fuck this. This is shit.
I mean, it does express that very real fear, and it probably expresses a very real fear from a person who is, by all accounts, successful. Because a lot
sure.
of people
however
are trying
you define that.
Exactly. People mm-hmm. are always trying to move past who they were, who everybody else is. You know, it is. I won't say everybody's like that. Not everybody's that shitty, but I will say when you start out, a lot of people, even if you think you're a good person, you might start out. Wanting to be better than, at least better than where you came from. And I feel like that's also part of it. Damn it, this album's deeper than I realized.
Well, and never, you know, never enough. That's, I think everybody feels that way to a certain extent. Like we can recognize it in ourselves and yeah. we can try to, you know, temper, you know, that greed. But, you know, I was just having the conversation the other day with somebody about, you know, the highway cones mm-hmm. that we all need to thread of like comfort and ambition.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're too comfortable and you're on that side of the highway cones, you're never going to do anything. You're just going to sit on your ass all day. But if you're too ambitious, now you're veering that side of the highway, you're too greedy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you need to be ambitious. You need to get out of bed in the morning and do some shit. But like, you also like need to be comfortable. Like you need to like, you know,
yeah.
keep yourself happy and fulfilled somehow.
Yeah. It's a very good point, Nick. I feel like we're really tearing my life open as we sit here and talk about
this is my new form of therapy where I just talk mm-hmm. at people.
Mm-hmm. It's good. No, it's good. Helps me because, you know, I obviously, you know, am not capable of talking about my own problems. So you can talk about my problems at me and it'll solve everything. It's perfect. Where the fuck are we? Oh, we're at I Dare You to Watch Me Sleep. That's where we are. I Dare You to Watch Me Sleep. The title alone.
This feels like the least parody-esque.
Uh-huh.
This feels like a straightforward... I mean, it's in that vein. It's still in that, like, you know, similar, like, milieu that he's been working. It doesn't feel awkward compared mm-hmm. to any of the other songs. But, like, if Work From Home, we'll say, like, is the furthest towards comedy, I would say this is the other side of the spectrum on that album.
Mm-hmm.
On this album, and you know it's got that vibe, man. It's just it does it very well, and the sort of like repetitive nature of the piano, and it kind of just meanders in that way that's like very much like classic rocky, or that edge of classic rock, you know, mm-hmm. Not prog rock, but those more Steely Dan-esque kind of bands.
Yeah. Do you know, I'm honestly, I feel like I've seen Tim Heidecker play guitar, but do you know if he plays mm-hmm. any other instruments? Because I really don't know what he played on here, honestly.
I don't know if he plays piano. I would assume he does.
Mm-hmm.
He seems like, to me, he seems like one of those guys, and this is said with all the love in my heart, especially being one of those guys who kind of plays everything a little bit shittily.
Sure.
Like, I'm sure he's got, like, you know, tons of instruments in his basement, mm-hmm. and I'm sure he's not, like, amazing at any of them.
Right.
Like, he can definitely pick up guitar and rock a guitar. He can probably, like, funk out some piano chords, play bass, right. and do all of it. But, like, you know, he's not going to be a Jaco Pastorius or a fucking Keith Jarrett or something.
Sure, neither of those guys.
Herbie Hancock. There we go.
Yeah, there we go.
There's a common piano reference.
Sure.
Some people know it from Tommy Boy.
Yeah. To be fair, that's probably where I learned it. Was it
there's no you definitely on. Heard Rocket. That's like sure. common.
Sure. And, now, I've heard Herbie the Hancock song,
was,
but...
Yeah, and Herbie Hancock was on Sesame Street.
Was he?
Totally. Oh, yeah. He's showing a bunch of kids a sampler. So he has,
I was
like,
about to ask you, who did he play? That's what I was about to say, Nick.
Literally a kid.
How about Central Air, Nick?
This is a great song to kind of back sort of in the like central, the central air of the album, if you will. But, you know, it's sort of like, it's like in Glendale or, you know, it's real. It's a real thing of like, you know, people are moving out of, you know, central Los Angeles, and they're moving to these kind of suburbs and gentrifying these neighborhoods, and these mm-hmm. places become hip all of a sudden, you know, like a Silver Lake or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
And so then Glendale, all of a sudden, you know, that's all the old people are dying or moving away. It's like, yep, this is how these things happen all the mm-hmm. time, you know,
mm-hmm.
Out to, you know, New York neighborhoods where all of a sudden the young people start moving there, and then the, you know, more rich people start moving there, and all of a sudden the young people can't afford to live there. Fuck, it's happening in Portland, Maine right now.
Fun.
But all of that within this context of like, well, it's really hot, and we need this just very basic convenience of mm-hmm. central air.
Yeah.
Like, it's awesome when you have it. But it's not life changing. You can get a window unit, dude.
Yep.
And they bought this house. You know, we're creating a family. We're, you know, all this. And once again, he's not going into any details. How does he feel about it?
We don't know.
You know, just here it is, bare. Mm-hmm. This is the bare facts. And we have central air.
Mm-hmm.
It also does one of those interesting things that I've been obsessed with in songwriting. Ever since I heard Moon and the Stars off of Songs for a New World, it's the Jason Robert Brown, he wrote that 5 years.
Yeah. I produced a show of that once.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So mm-hmm. Jason Robert Brown wrote this song cycle. It was kind of one of his early things for Recognition called Songs for a New World. And this song called Moon and the Stars, where the chorus... as a chorus often does, it just repeats throughout the song.
Sure.
But the emotional impact of that chorus changes after each verse because okay. the verses create this, you know, emotional arc.
He's good at
and
that.
The repetition of the same chorus changes each time
mm-hmm.
from, you know, hopeful to like very fucking depressing by the
okay.
end of it.
Okay.
Which is great. It's a great move. Mm-hmm. And I love that move. And I feel like the central air does a similar thing where the reference to the central air each time gains an emotional resonance from where we started to where we end.
Yeah.
You know, and the importance of it, even though it is, you know, a very basic convenience that is not necessary, mm-hmm. The emotional resonance of it, it becomes more and more sort of invested. You become more invested in it as like, mm-hmm. you know, a symbol is very strong, but like as like an important signifier of, you know, this world.
I like that. I also think there's an element of when he talks about things that are very banal, or as you say, just sort of says a thing that is happening without mm-hmm. addressing it. I feel like somebody like Ben Folds does that really well in a way that is maybe more emotional for me, because again, you are being given the border to the puzzle, and then whatever you fill in is kind of your own shit. And yeah. so if it is just a simple fact, like I was sitting there, this was happening, that was happening, you can plug in story details, but then it also emotionally starts becoming about you, if possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, it's a good artistic choice, and it is kind of a bit of a flex to do in a comedy song, because like it is challenging you to invest emotionally in something that is by and large supposed to be funny. But then if you invest in it emotionally, then it's an emotional song all of a sudden.
Yeah, totally, 100%. This isn't a scary movie.
That's very true. Very true. You know? Mm-hmm. Scream's original title, you know, was Scary Movie. That's a fact that everybody knows, I think. But I just thought I'd point that out.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, Scream was originally titled Scary Movie, and they said, nope, let's call it Scream. And then Scary Movie comes out parodying Scream. Ooh.
And this, of course, is to promote next week's episode with Matthew Lillard.
No. Maybe my least favorite thing from the 90s, Matthew Lillard. No.
Oh, it's one of my favorites.
I know. Yeah, but because you love Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, and
he does an okay Shaggy. I know he is Shaggy now, so I can't really say he does an okay Shaggy anymore. He is Shaggy now.
Yeah.
Back to Casey Kasem.
Like, dude,
like, holy cow, Scoob. I'm sure he's fine. I've actually heard he's a very nice person. As a matter of fact, I will point out, I've heard nothing bad about him as a human being, and he seems very genuinely kind. Matthew Lillard, you're welcome on the show before November. Can you imagine if Matthew...
I wonder what he'd talk about.
I do too, because, I mean, it could be Scooby-Doo. It could well be like, there's a billion Scooby-Doo records, so I'm sure he could pick one of those, but I don't know.
I feel like he's a fan of like, Nate Bargatze or something.
That would be really funny. It is.
Just like, you know, he's not like going to like a stadium tour of Dane Cook, I don't feel like.
Sure. But Nate Bargatze, that's a solid choice, former guest.
Oh, I bet you he's a huge Microbelia fan.
Oh, okay. That's good. No, that's good.
Yeah.
I can see that.
That's my guess.
People with money like Microbelia. That's true. I like him too, by the way. I find him fine.
Yeah.
He's interesting.
Don't have money. Is that what you're
saying? I mean, that's absolutely true. So I'm the outlier in that situation. Did you ever see that movie that he was in that's about fucking improv?
With Chris Gethard? No, I did not.
I have never turned a movie off quicker. And it's not because I won't say it was bad. I won't say it was made badly. And it was probably, I can't tell if I was supposed to be uncomfortable with the way they were, how accurately they were portraying improvisers, but I was so itchy. I was itching. I had to stop watching it.
Too real.
And I've never performed improv on stage. That's not true. I've done some improv on stage, but I mostly do in front of cameras.
Sure.
I know the people they were playing, and they were very real.
Yeah. I'll be honest. That was my takeaway from the trailer, and I was like, I never need to see this.
Nope. Yep. And not shitting on anybody involved with it, because everybody who's in it, I like.
No. And not shitting on people who do improv either. No. But same with community theater people. Like,
sure.
God bless them for doing it, but like, I don't want to hang out with you. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't need to. I don't need to. That's not the justification you're looking for in your life, is this dude hanging out with you while you get emotional about, I don't know, the third ensemble member of Mamma Mia? I don't know, man. You don't need me there.
Right.
You can have that experience and love that experience. And improv people, same thing. I've done improv on stage, and guess what? I'm fucking insufferable.
I would imagine you are the person who takes over in a fun way. Like, there are people who take over in a way that is nobody wants to watch that, and it's like the sort of, not to shit on Robin Williams, RIP, but supposedly that was his deal. Like, he would just he would bulldoze. I feel like you could bulldoze in a way where people would still be like, oh, but that was fun. That was fun.
I just got my fourth text in my life of somebody out of the blue being like, hey, no offense, but you remind me of Jason Mantzoukas. And every single time I'm like, why? No offense.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's really funny.
He's a very talented, funny guy.
Yeah. The only thing I wish I had of his is his voice. That's a voice I wish I had.
Is bonkers. Really? Right now?
I love also that yours is verging on, I just heard it, where it crossed from a very good, by the way, very good Jason Mantzoukas, almost into Scooby-Doo. It was very close to...
Never far from my, every impression I have has a little bit of it.
Yeah. Let's talk about I Saw Nicolas Cage.
The most L.A. song.
Yeah.
And nothing happens, really.
Right, right. Which, I mean, if we want to draw more Weird Al comparisons, he has that song Lame Claim to Fame, which is, you know, also about seeing, sort of roughly being adjacent to famous people or seeing them at a thing. Which, by the way, if you're from L.A., you're going to have those stories. Eventually, maybe you move past them, but maybe you don't, like I don't.
I had a friend who he moved to the Valley for, like, in his words, like the worst decision of his life. Mm-hmm. And he was there for like maybe 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept running into Chad Michael Murray in the same Starbucks. And, you know, nothing against Chad Michael Murray at all.
Sure.
But his impression mm-hmm. was that Chad Michael Murray was trying to simultaneously not be recognized. He was trying to be recognized by trying to seem like he wasn't trying to be recognized.
Yep. Sure.
Which, cool. You know, I mean, like, yeah. I get it, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, One Tree Hill was a show. And now you're getting that Marvel money, buddy. So, like, get into it.
Sure, sure.
But it's just, like, so funny, the idea of, like, I'm a level of success.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not being hounded by people. And I'm grateful for that. But I'm also an actor, which means that I'm looking for justification of my existence through recognition.
Yep. Yeah.
That's
yep.
just what it is, man. Mm-hmm. A stand-up comedian gets up on, doesn't get up on stage because they're like, I hope nobody looks at me. Fuck it, dude. We all have that bullshit in us of being like, you know, just laugh at me, recognize me, justify my existence, motherfucker.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's this idea of like... And Nicolas Cage, I'm sure, has like a very interesting relationship to fame, especially now.
Uh-huh.
And he's been through the ringer of, you know, that emotional roller coaster. But it's just the idea of like, what is he? He's like in traffic and shit, right?
Yeah, traffic's a big part of it.
Oh,
and
on
then
the radio,
straight up
Nicolas
death.
Cage. Yeah.
Uh huh.
But also, I saw Nicolas Cage, but then like I heard him on the radio. Like it's it's wonderful. Once again, just kind of like, he just talking about how he's hearing Nicolas Cage on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that good enough for a song? Okay,
right,
put it in.
Right. Yep.
Who cares? That's not the question we're asking.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I do like that. To name the song, the least consequential thing that's in the song is great.
Yeah.
You know, the person I saw the most was Cato Kaelin. And I will tell you, the second time I saw him, I was real down until I noticed that he was in the room. And I was like, I'm not Cato Kaelin. And I felt real good about myself for a couple minutes. And I'm like, you're an asshole for feeling this way. But what are you going to do?
That's that Paul F. Tompkins bit about mm-hmm. when he was working at a movie store in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And his coworker comes in, like, just laughing her ass off. And he's like, oh, this is going to be good. What happened? And her whole thing was like, I just saw Fabio. And he's like, well, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like, and then Fabio came into the video store and he started laughing.
Yep.
Just seeing Fabio was great.
Yep.
So funny. And he's like, this poor asshole has to be that guy of like, just walk, like, Fabio's feeling pretty good today. Gonna go walking down the street and people just start bursting out laughing at you. And it's like, fuck, that sucks.
It does. I haven't heard that bit, but that's very good. That's absolutely accurate to how I felt with Cato Kaelin. And I, again, sort of almost felt bad, but not really. Not really.
Well, what are the stakes? You know, it's not, you're not looking at the dude, like, laughing. And then the result of that is, like, this person's life goes down the drain. Like,
right.
That's an unfortunate part of your fame. And
yeah.
Guess what? You wanted to be famous
yeah.
and have money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I believe that's on Laboring Under Delusions, which is honestly my favorite Paul F. Tompkins album. The Live at the Bell House one,
right,
especially.
It is in that. Wait a minute. Is it not in the vid? No, it is. It must be, and I just forgot it.
I don't think so. I don't think it made it onto the
okay,
video
then maybe
special.
That's why, because I watched the video special not that long ago before I bought Crying and Driving.
The live at the Bell House is, I believe, more extended and just so good. He all opens up with this, this dumb bit about people, like construction workers. Do they think while they're in building a place, if they think of it as the skeleton of a house, and do they get scared?
Paul F. Tompkins, I will say all of his records need to be on vinyl. Number one, none of them are on vinyl. Number two, like, kind of like, it's one of those things where I feel like you don't have a podcast unless he's been on it. And he is a dream guest to the show, but, boy, oh boy, that, there's nothing he doesn't say things unfunny, and it's annoying.
Really. And genuine and seeming to enjoy the things that he's saying in a way that's not gross.
Yep. Exactly.
Like, he's not like, there's never like a winking, like, get a load of this. I'm about to drop some science.
No.
Like, he just seems to genuinely enjoy what he's talking about in a sincere, authentic way. And you're like, how is he that fucking self-realized?
He's done something where he is re-remembering, not faking, I don't think, re-remembering why he thought that was funny the first time. And that's when those genuine laughs come out. And it's like, fuck, man. That's a thing most people fake, I think. But
somehow
he never feels like he's faking it.
Yeah, like somehow he's managed to like actually deliver what Scientology promises. I don't know how he did it.
Oh, God, that's a thing I don't miss. Oh, God, but who knows? Like, every state's got one, doesn't it? I bet if I looked around, there's probably a center somewhere nearby.
That's a going thing for me and my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. It's a common element of somebody. Mm-hmm. Like when we're talking about people behind their back, which is there any greater joy in the world? And we'll be like, you know what, that person would definitely be a Scientologist.
Right.
That's like a click. That's a big box that we always check on a person. Would they be a Scientologist or not? Check. Nicolas Cage not a Scientologist, but self-proclaimed shaman.
That's boy. I don't know if I could handle interviewing that guy, but I would do it. I just don't know what it would do to me.
Paul Scheer recently talked about what a great experience it was to work with him.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
This album ends on a downer.
Mm-hmm. Ocean's Too Cold.
But like in a funny kind of way, you know?
Uh-huh.
The fact that it is this perspective of this father, like, hoping the best for his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this to me seems the most metaphorical song on the album. This like extends symbology to a point where it's like, this is a metaphor, the ocean's too cold, you know, as opposed to like Central Air, which I feel like, you know, does have metaphoric or symbolic aspects to it, but also is on the surface talking about what it's talking about. It's talking about Central Air.
Sure.
This ocean's too cold feels a little bit more, you know, that we're extending into a symbolic language, and these things are metaphorical, which, you know, I think is earned. I think being the only song on the album that really extends this far to that sort of aspect, you know, it doesn't feel forced compared to the other, you know, more literal songs on the album. Like it doesn't push it too far, but like it also gives us like something different and closes the album in a beautiful way. Cause then, you know, you're not you're left with this sort of like spinning out, you know, the psychic energy that we've sort of been like constricting to literality is able to sort of like expand and sort of like blow off steam.
Yeah, that's fair and brilliant and smarter than I would have said now.
And probably used about 75 words more than I needed to.
No. Nope, that's good. That's good thinker man talk, Nick. That's what I right now my brain doesn't work. So I'm glad to have guests on who know what they're talking about for these last few episodes. Do you have a favorite track then? I have to ask that.
I think it's probably Good Looking Babies.
Okay.
I don't know. There's songs on this that are super listenable.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are songs that are conceptually more fascinating. Sure. And I think, you know, Cleaning Up the Dog Shit is like super listenable. because it's just fun. You know, it's got that, you know, E Street Band, just kind of like, hey, kind of vibe. But conceptually, I think Good Looking Babies is like so well done.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of it and the execution of it are so in sync, you know, because having a premise versus executing that premise, you know, like something like the Super Ego album, I think like does like a really good job of having that outlaw premise, the country outlaw album. But the execution of it doesn't feel forced or overly parodic.
You
know, it marries those things well, and I think this does a similar thing where the you know, content and form match each other amazingly well.
That's a good argument, Nick.
Thanks, man.
You're welcome. Thanks for
being
here.
You're super nice. Can you fight me at least on one thing?
I can't. No, because you've had more time to think about it, and you were smarter about music than I will ever be. Nick, thank you for coming back for your final episode, unless, of course, you know, down the line you release something on vinyl that is comedy, at which point we'll do a special episode with Nick Robes where we talk about whatever.
Ooh, yeah, that's really fun.
Yeah, that sounds good. What where can people find you? What do you want to promote?
You know, these days I don't really have a ton. Listen to the back catalog of this. Go check out my buddy Aaron Reynolds' book, Effing Birds. It's fucking hilarious. It's birds swearing and Aaron just bitching about old coworkers in a book that's supposedly about ornithology.
I love it.
It's so funny.
That's really
good. Yeah, back catalog of What's With You, Scooby-Doo is out there. You can listen to that. Some great, you've been a guest. James Bladen's been a guest.
Yes.
Yeah, check that out, I guess. If you like hearing people talk and not talk about Scooby-Doo.
Sure, of course. You're at Nick Robes on Twitter, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I tweet once every like 7 months. I did have, I think I had a great hot take on the Jeff Bezos dick rocket. So go read that tweet.
Go read that tweet. I like the idea of specifically promoting a single tweet.
A tweet, yeah.
Not my pinned tweet, but this one I want you to check out from You Do the Math and then et cetera, et cetera. And move on from there.
Sure,
that.
Remember when that dick rocket went up and then find that date. I will say I'm pretty proud of my pinned tweet, even though I know that it's no longer true. It was my year-long just attempt to try to get Kenny Loggins to admit that he sang the Gummy Bears theme song, which he did not, but it sounded so much like him that I refused to look it up for so long and just said it was Kenny Loggins with gusto, and then found out, spoiler alert, it was not Kenny Loggins, but it was just the most innocuous thing to harass him about on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he was he cool about it? Did he ever respond?
He never responded, and I'm assuming he also just didn't take the time to block me either.
Sure.
Doesn't seem like it. So maybe he took it in stride, or maybe he just never saw it.
Did you ask Messina? Maybe Messina knows if Loggins did it.
So it come to find out, it's actually a much weirder story. It is the son of John Williams.
Really?
Who ended up going on to become the lead singer of Toto.
This I did not know. That's very interesting to me.
Wow. And that was the only one that he did, I think, of the
weird.
Disney, of the famous like Disney afternoon
theme
really song.
Funny. Okay.
Yeah, because DuckTales was like another dude. And then, of course, Darkwing Duck has that wonderful backing group of women singers. Better watch out, you bad boys.
Such a good song. Yeah. They're all so good.
There's more useless information for your audience.
That's good. No, thank you, Nick. thank you for being a huge part of the show. Every time you come on, you're so good.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Congratulations on so many great episodes. You know, I'm a fan of the show. I've enjoyed previous episodes. While sad that it is coming to an end, I think that we should rejoice over the milestones that have been crossed and the joy that you've created.
I will take it, Nick. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Don't be sad because it's ending. Be happy because it happened.
Wow. Thank you, Nick. I feel like it sounds like I'm being insincere. I'm just exhausted. So I mean the things I'm saying, but yeah. I'm saying them in an insincere way, but I actually do mean thank you, Nick. I also am uncomfortable with emotion, and that is how I function as a person. Thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!